the province a place where young people want to stay, build their lives, and be proud to be a part of. Fastenau, however, went against this by saying that Rustad speaks on this a lot, but never actually speaks about investing in young people or solutions for young people, only the problems that young people are facing today. And she says that we need to give young people a reason to stay, to which Ebi then came in to criticize Rustad on his housing policy for the Rustad rebate for young people, saying that benefits from his proposed rebate will not actually be seen until at least 2029, and that young people are not going to be seeing any benefits at all, and it will only be homeowners seeing the benefits, with rural BC residents and renters not seeing any benefits either. Kind of criticizing that Rustad is heavily focusing on youth and making BC a place for youth to be happy and want to stay, but his proposals are not actually investing and targeted towards youth. They then went on to tackle housing affordability, which is obviously a key issue for voters, has been seen as a key issue throughout the campaigning so far. And the Shachi opened it up by asking Rustad what he will do when he says that he will undo NDP policies, including rent caps, restrictions on short-term rentals, and allowing more density on single-family lots. Rustad, however, responded saying that this was not true. He is not planning to undo any rent caps, and that he actually wants to work with local governments to clean up the backlog in permits to get more housing, and quickly. Shachi then went to EB to say, with a different question, what he will say to those who feel upward mobility is no longer an option for them in BC. And EB said that he wants to invest in modular housing construction in order to expedite the process, as well as preserve lower cost housing. And he plans to deliver 300,000 middle income homes. And then Fastenau was asked actually on her party's measures to cool the market to make housing more affordable for everyone, but how will she do it without devaluing what has been considered to be people's largest financial asset? And Fastenau went in to say that she actually wants rent caps that to be put in place between tenancies, as that is where the price is getting jacked up, and she wants non-market housing, which is housing for low moderate income single and families, and are often subsidized through a variety of ways but managed through various operators such as public, non-profit, co-op and indigenous sectors. There was then a question posed to everyone on housing, and it was asking whether the housing policy should go back to being more market driven or have greater government intervention. To which there was a very open debate on the private sector and Rustad's comment of unleashing the private sector, which Fastenau argued is what the BC Liberals did back in the 2000s, and all it does is make more profit for the private sector and add to the lack of affordability for BC people. She argues that the unleashing of the private sector is what has gotten them to where we are today, and that it isn't a proper solution, it's going back to the past, and she wants a bigger focus on global organizations buying up housing in BC and leaving them vacant for profit. They then went on to debate healthcare, and Ebi went in on Rustad's anti-vaccine stance that has been in the media a lot lately, despite Rustad saying he's triple vaccinated. And there were comments made as well by Ebi in response to a question that Rustad answered, comparing the support for prosecuting healthcare workers for their actions during the COVID-19 pandemic to that of Nazi war criminals. Rustad, however, has apologized for this comment after it was posted online, saying he misunderstood the question, and this was all before the debate. And he clarified during the debate that he is not anti-vaccine, but actually anti-mandate, emphasizing that he himself is triple vaccinated. So he's not actually anti-vaccine. He says he is anti-mandate. And what was an interesting turn in this was First Now speaking on how the BC NDP and the BC Conservatives focus on the need for more healthcare staff and the need to train up more doctors, and we just need to keep getting more healthcare workers. She says that is not the case, that BC have more family doctors per capita than the rest of Canada, and they just don't want to work in the broken system that is the healthcare system in BC. And the focus shouldn't be on training up more doctors. It should be on fixing what is considered to be a very broken system already. Then sort of linking in, they went on to the topic of the opioid crisis and organized crime with public safety. First Now opened with how she wants to continue with the safe supply and focus on prevention and destigmatization of opioids, and focusing in on young people. She says young people need to be getting good and reliable information on drugs. She compared it to a US study that showed a reduction in 66% of usage in hard drugs from young people that had received good education on the effects and risks of hard drugs. And she argues that we need more counselors in schools, and young people need to feel supported in schools rather than stigmatized. And then EB went in on Rustad, saying that Rustad wants to clear tent encampments and close overdose prevention sites and focus on drug-free housing. It wasn't clear whether Rustad was saying that he was doing this. It was very muddled. This part, it was very much EB versus Rustad going, firing shots at each other. But Rustad did say that he wants to provide solutions for three main categories of people that do fall into the opioid crisis and become homeless. He wants to offer more help in housing for those that he considered down on their luck, and more assistance in detox for those that are suffering with addiction, as well as more support for those that are having mental health problems that are relating to them being homeless. And EB spoke on opening new treatment beds with increased support for youth and people in recovery. There was a small sort of open debate discussion with organized crime and the opioid crisis after this, with Rustad saying he will crack down on ports and strengthen border control in order to prevent harmful substances coming in and circulating in the BC communities. And EB said that this isn't a solution, and what actually needs to be done is enforcing the law more strongly. And then fired shots at Rustad's view to not enforce federal gun laws in BC, which then led to First Now talking about a transitional housing model called The Village that's seen a proven success in Duncan, providing safe short-term and transitional housing for women and families to combat the homelessness crisis that is linked with opioid crisis and organized crime. And she says it's been a proven success. It's been operating for 4 years and has seen dozens and dozens of people come out of homelessness and improve their lives. Right after that, they went into discussing Indigenous rights and land use and reconciliation with the Indigenous groups of British Columbia. Shachi went to EB first and asked him if he would attempt to re-amend the Land Act, and he said he would not, because the focus should not be with spending millions of dollars on legal fees and lawyers to be stuck in a back and forth battle with the courts. He said he thinks it's more important there is a collaborative partnership with Indigenous people to improve the quality of everybody's lives, and says that Rustad is not doing this and will spread division, with some of his candidates being openly racist and denying the history of residential schools. Rustad said that he wanted to focus on an economic reconciliation and to get rid of legislation that is causing the friction between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people of BC. He was not specific, though, on what legislation that would be. And First Now agreed with EB in that time should not be spent in court and with millions of dollars being wasted on legal fees. She says that for reconciliation, the focus should be doing the hard, essential work, with governments needing to sort out and do the work for reconciliation at a negotiating table, and really emphasized on the hard, essential work that needs to go into reconciliation rather than changing legislation. And the final topic that they went in to debate was the future of BC, which saw their closing statements as well. And this topic was opened by First Now. She spoke about wanting to tax the correct wealth bracket for more economic equity, speaking on EB and Rustad being only aligned with subsidizing fossil fuels and building more LNG infrastructure, with LNG facilities going from 0 to potentially 7 under NDP power at the moment. She sees the future of BC being clean energy, and that the BC Greens are the only party promising to keep the carbon tax to achieve this. Rustad, however, was said to be a denier of climate change, and has said that he wants to get rid of both the carbon tax and the gas tax, as well as the low carbon fuel standard. And EB commented on that Rustad's promises for change cannot be made under BC jurisdiction again, only federal jurisdiction. And on climate crisis, EB went in on Rustad comparing the ridiculousness of the decriminalization of drugs and the use of hard drugs being allowed, but not being able to use a plastic straw. And then EB went to say that the path forward is to be developing electricity and hydroelectricity and giving solutions for now, which he quoted, unlike Rustad, where you won't see the benefits until at least 2029. But Rustad was focusing more on a common sense plan, as he said. However, there towards the end, it was a bit of a battle of EB asking Rustad for why he hasn't got a costed platform, and Rustad not really responding. I would definitely say that is just a very quick overview of some of the key points that I took out of the election. I would definitely say that to go back and watch it is online, and it is definitely worth a watch if you are considering to vote, which I would strongly encourage everyone to be voting. And I want to leave you all with an interview that our public affairs work study has done, Iago, on the recent hurricane in Florida. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Speak Up this morning. And remember to tune in next week as well for more election coverage. And remember, the final day for voting is October 19th.
Welcome to CJSF 90.1. Today we're speaking with Jen Huff, who recently traveled to Florida West Coast to help her mom to evacuate ahead of Hurricane Milton. This hurricane comes just over a week after the region was hit by Hurricane Helene. And apparently it hit landfall as a Category 3 storm, and it caused already widespread damage, and it came with multiple tornadoes. As climate disasters like this become more frequent and more intense, I believe we'll be discussing today her personal experience with hurricanes, and also some of the evacuation process, the impact of communities in Florida, and also the growing conversation around that and climate change. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here in this difficult time, Jem. And would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Jen, and this is not my first rodeo with the hurricanes. I've been traveling back and forth to Florida to help my folks out in various storms. This will be the fourth hurricane that we've had to deal with, and the last one, Helen, did quite a bit of damage without actually hitting the area where my folks live, which is in Southwest Florida. Between Tampa and Fort Myers is where their homes are. I've been doing this for as long as I can remember now, and I'm I'm getting so tired of it. And climate change has not helped matters. It's just getting worse and worse and worse.
I can't agree more. I would like first to thank you again for being here in this hard time. As long as I know, you're actually like now evacuated and safe, but still like following the damage that's happening to your house and following everything that's happening with everyone. You told me that a few people in the region that you're close to right now died early with the tornadoes. It's not an easy time.
No.
You've also mentioned that you've dealt with that a couple of times before. I know you don't need to touch on everything, but how's that experience has been to you? Like, did it destroy your home before? What are you facing right now?
Well, I could go back to, I think it was 2004, Hurricane Charley, and that was a direct hit where my parents live in Punta Gorda. And that hurricane came in as a Category 4. They were very, very fortunate. There wasn't a storm surge with that. It was a very small and tight contained storm, but did a lot of wind damage. And so my dad's home was pretty much wrecked inside and out. The windows and the doors were blown in, basically because they were tornadic winds, 150 mile an hour winds sustained in that storm. And I think that's 170 kilometers an hour, something like that. So that was pretty bad. My mom's place was damaged pretty bad. I think she was without electricity for over a month. And I actually came in that evening while the storm had just hit. I got on a plane that night from Seattle and flew down to Fort Myers, got in a rental car, and I was driving in behind the National Guard that was coming in. And I was down there for about a month. And every time I would go over to my dad's, the National Guard would stop me and load up my SUV with military rations and ice for me to pass out to, different people in the neighborhood and stuff. So that was my first experience. And then the second one was, I think it would have been Ian, which was 2 years ago. And that one, I actually was able to, I told my parents they couldn't stay any longer. Both of them stayed during Charley, and it was very dangerous. And I told them they had to evacuate. And so I was able to get them up to Orlando into a hotel for Hurricane Ian. That one as well did a lot of damage. I mean, more widespread than even Charley did. And I don't know if you have a website or something, I have photographs I could send you if you wanted to post some photographs of some of the damage. And then the third one was Helen, which just recently happened. And that one pretty much skimmed the side of them and went up north and hit the panhandle of Florida. The weird thing is that's the first time my dad's place ever flooded. And they had a big storm surge during that. And a lot of people, I have a friend that her car was in her garage and it flooded 3 feet into the garage and totaled the car because it fried the electrical system. But a lot of people lost their homes with the flooding from Helen, which was just maybe 4 weeks ago, I think. So here we are, another one that was going to be a Category 5. Thankfully, it slowed down and it came on shore as a Category 3. And it did come ashore up near Tampa, which we're waiting to see if that's an okay thing for us. We didn't bear the brunt of the eye wall, which is good, but we're going to bear the brunt of the storm surge, which is currently rising. I'm looking at my dad's feed right now, and I can see the water right in front of his house at the moment. So But we still have electricity, amazingly.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I think most of the people who are hearing don't have much or any experience with that. We don't see any heating in Canada, at least not here on the West Coast. And the maximum we've seen was like tornado hitting UBC a couple of years
ago.
And it's devastating for the life of everyone who's involved. The anxiety with the destruction of everything that you possess. And also the fear for everyone that you know that don't have the chance to evacuate. And that we've been seeing more and more floods all around the world. We also know that these are the ones that actually kill people. It's not the hurricanes itself. It's not the winds, I mean. And so we are looking at an enormous quantity. You're seeing that in Pakistan, we've seen it in Brazil. And how do you feel about that? Like, how does the climate come to affect more and more vulnerable communities?
It's incredibly frustrating because the people that live in these communities will not evacuate. And I think after Ian and what happened in Fort Myers, a lot of people learned their lessons. However, there are still people, like I knew people, my father's next door neighbor actually wasn't going to evacuate, but he actually did finally. And his wife is bedridden, so he got her in the car and he drove her down to Miami. But there's so many people down there that will not evacuate no matter what. And, having experienced earthquakes myself and having experienced these now, I mean, I don't experience them, but I have, I was on the phone with my mom when her roof blew off in Hurricane Charlie. You know, I've seen the devastation that happens. In Hurricane Ian, the people that died were people that stayed behind and they drowned because their houses were inundated with water from the storm surge. And you just can't stop that. And it's a fact of climate change, and the representatives in Florida don't accurately reflect voting for legislation that supports rebuilding efforts. And we have what we call Federal Emergency Management Association or Federal Emergency Management Agency, I think is what it's called. But 100 plus GOP Republicans voted against funding this year for that organization, which is the organization that comes in after these disasters and helps people rebuild and get back on their feet during these disasters. So, and they're just getting worse. The hurricanes are just getting worse and more frequent and more powerful. I mean, what we were looking at earlier, my mom was just devastated. She felt like we were going to go home, and we still may go back there and find nothing. But, it's a little bit more hopeful now because it came ashore as a Category 3 as opposed to a Category 5, which would have been, it just would have leveled everything. So it's insanity, and I don't know. There's no solution, I don't think. I think we just have to get better people in office that will support legislation that will, help curtail some of the global warming and maybe affect some of the climate change that's happening. But I think we may be past the point of no return on that.
And we see, as you said, more and more expected with the heat of the Atlantic Ocean, and the more hot it is, the more hurricanes, the more powerful they're going to be. So we do expect some level of policy support, but we see none. We actually have seen the same in Brazil. Just, I think, 2 months before the big floods this year that killed, like, that killed, I think, almost 1,000 people, they actually negated legislation that was going to help rebuild cities after those, as cities are built on the side of the on the river. So yeah, we young generation, we want to see more of that, and we are afraid, but enough comes to play. Do you see like conspiracy theories playing a role also in like those legislations not passing? I think there's quite a bunch out there right now during this hurricane as well, right?
Oh yeah, there's you know, they had to have press conference after press conference after press conference today because there are representatives that are elected representatives. One of them in particular saying that the government controls the weather systems, and you know, the government is not reacting to the disasters when they are, and they are doing what they're supposed to do, and they're communicating with the states. When, you know, this last storm, Helen or Helene, or I remember what her name is now, but you know, they're doing what they need to do, and they shouldn't have to get on the TV and talk about it and tell people that they're doing what they're supposed to do. You know, I've seen it. I've seen the National Guard riding in right after the storm. I've seen the electric trucks, caravans of them, you know, this storm, just driving down the highway, getting ready to help support people that have lost power. You know, this conspiracy theories do nothing for anybody but just sow distrust and contribute to people not listening and evacuating when they need to and getting out of harm's way. And it's just,
it's true. The more and more people are polarized and the more people are divided, the more they look for something that's try to explain what's happening to them. I don't know. I particularly don't have much of an explanation of why more and more of those theories come up. We've seen like political members citing that Republicans would not have been receiving like support of the post-aid kits and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not true, and it implicates a direct role in like how people are actually receiving that that help afterwards. Do you particularly have any explanation that you've seen, like how does the polarization and how does the current like tension in the political world is affecting how people are seeing this scene?
I can give you my opinion, and that's the best I can do. But I can tell you that since the election of 2016, an administration that was in office then, it started there, and it started dividing people, and rather than uniting people like we saw and you know, I'm referring to 9/11 now, showing my age, but when 9/11 happened, we were all united as a country, and the world united for us as a country. And, you know, we didn't do the greatest things afterwards. You know, we invaded countries that we probably shouldn't have. And lots of people lost their lives. But when 9/11 happened, the population in the U.S., it was a feeling I'd never experienced before. And since 2016, it's just been a divided and contentious, and I think it's because of us versus them mentality. There's just so much negativity out there, and you know, I guess I attribute it starting then, and it's just not getting any better. And hopefully, after this election, we will see an improvement. I hope, and if we can get back to normal again, maybe 4 years of normal might level things out a bit. I hope, you know.
Well, thank you for all of those insights. They've been great for, I think, us to understand what is actually going on, what's the political scene, what's the emotional scene at the moment. Do you have like any final message that you would like to put out there for everyone hearing us?
I sure would. I would love to say that, like I said, I gave away my age. I was around when 9/11 happened. I am hopeful that the youth of our countries are going to come forward and tackle climate change and put in policies and people in place that will affect change. And that's where my hope lies. So if you're listening to this, and